In our discussions of the Heart Sutra, we've taken a little diversion into the shamatha practice for the last few sessions. And of course the reason being is that if we want our emptiness practice, vipassana practice, or for that matter any practice to be effective, we need to have a very stable, clear, focused mind. So we spent a little bit of time there looking at the shamatha practice, in particular focusing a little bit on the practice of observing the mind and resting in awareness, because these practices, apart from being very effective shamatha practices, can also be a practice that leads us easily into the vipassana practice, particularly the realizing the nature of the mind. And of course here also in the Heart Sutra, in Avalokiteshvara's response to how to practice this wisdom of emptiness along the various stages of the path, then of course as part of that path we would have that mind of shamatha anyway. So let's now return back to the Heart Sutra. And so we're sort of halfway down on the first page there. So far we've covered, of course, the prologue, the setting, you know, where this sutra took place. It took place in Rajgir. There was a lot of monks and bodhisattvas present. The Bhagavan, the Buddha, was there, of course. To the audience, he appeared to be absorbed in deep meditation, but was completely aware of everything that was going on. We also, of course, had Avalokiteshvara present, or Chen Rizik in Tibetan, appearing to the audience at least as a high-level bodhisattva. And he was also contemplating this practice of emptiness, seeing that the five aggregates also were empty of inherent nature, meaning not just the person, but the basis of the person, the body and the mind, were also empty of inherent nature. And then we have Shariputra there as well, appearing as an arhat to the audience. And Shariputra was asking a question to Avalokiteshvara, which of course this whole discussion has been orchestrated by the power of the Buddha's mind, his concentration. And so Shariputra is asking of Avalokiteshvara, how should any son of the lineage train who wishes to practice the activity of the profound perfection of wisdom? Again, meaning, how should someone who has activated their Mahayana lineage, meaning has developed great compassion, and is aspiring to follow the Mahayana path, how should they practice this wisdom of emptiness? And the answer that Avalokiteshvara is about to give here, we can divide up into how to practice the wisdom of emptiness over the various stages of the Mahayana path. And the first part of the answer is how to practice this wisdom of emptiness on the first two stages of the path of accumulation and the path of preparation. So let's now have a look at that. So the first part of the answer is, again, just a transition. It says, he said that, and the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara said this to the Venerable Sharadvatriputra. Shariputra, any son of the lineage or daughter of the lineage who wishes to practice the activity of the profound perfection of wisdom should look upon it like this. So hasn't really said anything yet. It's just transitioning into the reply. So of course he's saying any son of the lineage or daughter of the lineage, which means anyone who's following the lineage, whether you're male or female, doesn't matter. It's completely equal. How should they practice this wisdom of emptiness? And what we see here is the answer we can divide into sort of two parts. The outline says mode of training in brief and then extensive presentation. So the mode of training in brief is like the short answer. The short answer of how to practice on the first two stages of the path. And here the answer says, correctly and repeatedly beholding those five aggregates also as empty of inherent nature. Now, this phrase here, empty of inherent nature, of course, is emptiness. That emptiness is the fact that everything is empty of inherent nature, sometimes called inherent existence, independent existence. There's a number of different terms used, which we'll look at shortly. But remember, we looked at those four seals. You know, the third seal was that all phenomena are empty and selfless. And that all Buddhist philosophical schools accept this statement. But how they interpret this word empty and selfless is different. Because remember, the Buddha taught according to people's dispositions, their capacities. And hence we have these three turnings of the wheel of Dharma. The Four Noble Truths, the second wheel of the Perfection of Wisdom teachings called Without Characteristics, and then the third turning of the wheel, this fine discrimination. And from those three turnings of the wheel of Dharma, we have those four philosophical schools being formed in ancient India. And why do we need to look at those four philosophical schools? Why don't we just look at this view of emptiness here? And it's because, again, these different philosophical systems can be very helpful to us, not only in a practical way, but as stepping stones to come to the most profound view of reality. And so, based on that idea, I'd like to read a little bit what His Holiness Dalai Lama says about that, about these four schools, and that is on page 99, if anyone has the book. He says, before we return to examining the text of the Heart Sutra, let's look at selflessness through the eyes of the various Buddhist schools so that we can attain a more refined understanding of emptiness as presented in the Heart Sutra. As I explained earlier, a belief in selflessness is essential to all Buddhist schools. But there is a variety of interpretations among them as to what precisely that term means. Within the Tibetan monastic curriculum, there is an entire genre of literature outlining in detail each school's way of understanding these matters. These are known as the tenets of each particular school. Within this literature, the various philosophical perspectives are ascribed to four main schools prevalent in ancient India, and the presentation of selflessness becomes progressively subtler with the arising of each school. These schools are the Vaibhashika school, the Sautrantika school, the Chittamatra or mind-only school, and the Majjhimika or middle way school. Tibetan Buddhists generally subscribe to the views of the final school, the middle way school, or the Majjhimika school. You might wonder why it is then that so much time should be spent dissecting the views of these other schools. How does it relate to the larger enterprise of liberation and enlightenment? Since the correct understanding of emptiness is crucial for success in eliminating the mental afflictions, it is important to examine the many places where we might stray from the path of right understanding. The views of earlier schools represent ways that Buddhists have historically fallen short of the most exhaustive application of the Buddhist teachings on emptiness. Studying the tenets of these schools helps us avoid becoming stuck in what is only a partial understanding of the true nature of emptiness. it also gives us a greater appreciation for the profundity of the most subtle standpoint. Of course, a correct intellectual view is no substitute for the direct realization of emptiness, which is non-conceptual, but it is a vital tool nonetheless in the task of approaching that realization. The texts on tenets differentiate between two kinds of selflessness: selflessness of the person and selflessness of phenomena. Person here refers to our strong sense of self, the I with which we refer to ourselves. Phenomena refers primarily to the mental and physical aggregates of the person, but includes all other phenomena as well. Among the four Buddhist schools, the two earlier ones, the Vaibhashika school and the Sautrantika school, speak only of the importance of meditating on the selflessness of the person, and they do not accept any notion of the selflessness of phenomena. However, in the two latter schools, the mind-only school and the middle way school, accept the doctrines of both the selflessness of the person and of phenomena. These schools would argue that a limited notion of selflessness, one referring only to the person, prevents us from eliminating the full range of obscurations and afflictions, as we shall see below. So although firmly realizing emptiness of person alone would be a tremendous accomplishment, it still falls short of complete liberation from suffering. So that's what we're going to do now, is have a look at these four schools in terms of their understanding of emptiness or selflessness, and thereby use the earlier schools as like a stepping stone to our discussion on emptiness, so that we can maybe better appreciate what this emptiness really means. So, in His Holiness' book, he talked about this two types of selflessness. There's selflessness of person and selflessness of phenomena. And so, person here, of course, is sense of me the person. And phenomena is everything other than person. As His Holiness mentioned, primarily we're talking about the body and the mind, but includes, of course, all other phenomena that exist. And as we saw in those four philosophical schools, then in terms of this ignorance, this grasping at self, in the two lower schools, they only talk about grasping at self in terms of person. So in the first two schools, which is the Vaibhashika and the Sautrantika school, then they only talk about the selflessness of person, no self. Whereas they wouldn't say selflessness of phenomena, because phenomena really do have their own self-existence. There is this independent objective world out there. So they wouldn't talk about selflessness of phenomena. Whereas the two latter schools, the Chittamatra and the Majjhimika schools, both of these, again, this is coming from the first turning of the wheel of Dharma, the Majjhimika from the second and the Chittimatra from the third. Both of these schools, of course, accept there's softness as a person, but also they would say that the physical world that appears to us is deceptive, that things are not existing in the way they appear. There is no self-existent, independent, objective world out there. So in that sense, they talk about selfness as a phenomena as well. And, of course, when we talk about this word selflessness, we can also talk about the word emptiness. And in that third seal, we saw that all these four schools say that all phenomena are empty and selfless. We have to understand what those words mean. So what I'd like to do now is to have a look at emptiness and selflessness according to the earlier schools before we launch into the Majjhimika system, which is what the Heart Sutra is describing, so that we can have a good basis for our emptiness discussions. So again, when we talk about, we'll talk first about the first two schools. Again, if we look at our the four Buddhist tenet systems chart, we can see that the first two schools, the Vaibhashika Sautrantika, if we look over in the column of proponent, it says a person propounding Hinayana tenets. So Hinayana tenets is just talking about tenets where the goal of the spiritual path is personal liberation, is nirvana. The first one says does not accept self-cognition. Sautrantika says accepts self-cognition. So again, that's not really any interest to us in this context. But what both of them say is they do accept truly existent external objects, meaning that they both accept that there is a truly existent external world out there, independent of us. And that when we talk about selflessness then in these two schools, we're only really talking about selflessness of person. Now, when we talk about self then, so remember I said the other day, the word self, we have to be careful when we hear it in Buddhist texts or see it in Buddhist texts. When the context of the discussion is about reality, the word self is talking about an overinflated sense of me. Whereas in other contexts or other teachings of Buddhism, for example, when we talk about self and others, then the word self is simply referring to person. And it's not used in a sense of how that person exists. Self just means myself versus others. Whereas here, in a discussion about the view of reality, the word self is talking about a specific way in which we see ourselves existing, in this very solid, substantial way. Now, in these two schools, and for our discussions, we're going to use the chart here below the four Buddhist schools, these objects of abandonment, so just keep that handy, is that in both of these schools, they talk about two false ways in which we inflate the sense of me. And the first one is related to a little bit to traditions that were existing at the time of the Buddha. Because any tradition that talks about something after this life has to talk about what goes from life to life. And if, of course, if they talk about some goal of liberation, what achieves liberation from suffering. And at the time of the Buddha, there were a number of traditions that had these ideas, and often many of these traditions said that the thing that went from life to life and achieved liberation was, in fact, this self. And this is, of course, a translation of the Sanskrit word Atman. And these traditions, many of these traditions were saying that this self that went from life to life and achieved liberation had three qualities. It was unchanging. Because when they looked at the body and the mind, they saw that these were changing. They didn't have any stability. So that couldn't be the thing that sort of continued on. Because certainly this body collapses at the time of death, and also this mind is very unstable. So that couldn't really be what was going from life to life. We need something with some stability. So it was the self, and this self was something that was unchanging.
That was before the Buddha?
Around the time of the Buddha, yeah.
Sorry.
Before and after, and I think probably still today. Still today, there are some philosophical systems that would accept this.
So the karma was, like the idea of karma was before the Buddha?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of these ideas or similar ideas were existing already before the time of the Buddha, yes.
You just said it was in that way.
Yeah, so there was a number of systems that were saying this even before the time of the Buddha, and I think even today there are some systems which would accept this.
Yeah.
So the second quality that this self had was that it was unitary. Unitary means, of course, a single thing, indivisible, no parts. And that it was completely independent of everything else, not depending on anything else to exist. And the Buddha refuted this idea of self. Because actually, if we look at these properties or characteristics, they're sort of a little bit illogical, because this idea of self would imply that we can have a sense of me or self somewhere over there. That this sense of self, it would be completely independent of this body and the mind. But we never have a sense of self or me completely independent of this body and the mind. So from a Buddhist perspective, this idea of self is only something that we would come to through some intellectual process of thinking, okay, if there's something going from life to life, for that to be able to do it, it must have these qualities to be able to do that. But again, from the Buddhist perspective, we don't instinctively have this sense of self. And remember, it's our instinctive sense of self that is driving our behavior. So this is merely some intellectual idea that we may get through some wrong way of thinking. But this was refuted, of course, by the Buddha because of these reasons, because it would be illogical. If it was unchanging, it couldn't really do anything. Now, within that, then, one thing that we can draw from this is this idea of unchanging. And I use the word unchanging here instead of permanent. Because, again, the word permanent and impermanent in our English language can be a bit misleading. Because usually when we use the word permanent or impermanent, we're sort of talking about how long does something last. You know, something's permanent if it really lasts at least a long time, if not forever. And something's impermanent, meaning, well, it's not going to last very long. Whereas here, the word, which is normally translated as permanent and impermanent, literally means changing and unchanging. So when we see the word permanent, impermanent, we're talking about, does this thing change from one moment to the next? We're not really talking about how long it lasts. So here, unchanging means not changing from one moment to the next. And what we can draw from this is that even though we really don't have this instinctive false sense of me, this one, this false sense of self, that we can look at this first term, the unchanging. And the opposite of that, of course, is changing or impermanence. And I think this, as we see in the base Vipassana practice, is the first thing we're trying to realize, the idea of anicca, you know, impermanence. Because that realization can really be very helpful to us, that if we can experientially see things as in a constant flow, then actually it becomes difficult to have craving and attachment towards anything, because there's nothing solid to grab. So often in the texts, when they talk about specific antidotes to attachment, one of the recommended meditations is impermanence, in fact, to come to experience things as impermanent. And so that can really help dramatically reduce our attachments and also our aversions. And normally when it comes to impermanence, we look at that in terms of good things coming to an end. And so usually we feel as if impermanence is sort of bad news, you know. But rather, we should, if we understand impermanence well, it's actually good news. Because if things didn't change, we'd be stuck. We couldn't improve. And so on that note, as some very practical advice about impermanence, I'd like to read a little bit from this book here, What Makes You Not a Buddhist, regarding impermanence. And it's on page 30, and the section in the book is called Impermanence is Good News. So I think there's some nice advice here, so I'd like to read it out to you. He says, Buddha was not a pessimist or a doomsayer. He was a realist, while we tend to be escapists. When he stated that all assembled things are impermanent, he did not intend for that to be bad news. It is a simple scientific fact. Depending on your perspective and on your understanding of this fact, it can become a gateway to inspiration and hope, glory and success. For example, to the extent that global warming and poverty are products of insatiable capitalistic conditions, these misfortunes can be reversed. This is thanks to the impermanent nature of assembled phenomena. Instead of depending on supernatural powers, such as God's will, to reverse such negative trends, a simple understanding of the nature of assembled phenomena is all that is needed. When you understand phenomena, you can manipulate them and thus affect causes and conditions. Recognizing the instability of causes and conditions leads us to understand our power to transform obstacles and make the impossible possible. This is true in every area of life. If you don't have a Ferrari, you very well may create the conditions to have one. As long as there is a Ferrari, there is the opportunity for you to own one. Likewise, if you want to live longer, you can choose to stop smoking and exercise more. There is reasonable hope. Hopelessness, just like its opposite, blind hope, is the result of a belief in permanence. You can transform not only your physical world, but your emotional world. For example, turning agitation into peace of mind by letting go of ambition, or turning low self-respect into confidence by acting out of kindness and philanthropy. If we all condition ourselves to put our feet in other people's shoes, we will cultivate peace in our homes, with our neighbours, and with our other countries. These are all examples of how we can affect assemble phenomena on a mundane level. Siddhartha also found that even the most feared levels of hell and damnation are impermanent, because they too are assembled. Hell does not exist as a permanent state somewhere underground where the damned suffer eternal torture. It is more like a nightmare. A dream in which an elephant tramples you comes about because of a number of conditions. First of all, sleep, and perhaps you have some negative history with elephants. It doesn't matter how long the nightmare lasts, during that time you are in hell. Then because of the causes and conditions of an alarm clock, or because you simply have finished sleeping, you wake up. The dream is a temporary hell, and it is not unlike our concepts of a real hell. Similarly, if you have hatred toward a person and engage in acts of aggression or revenge, that in itself is an experience of hell. Hatred, political manipulation, and revenge have caused hell on this earth. For example, when a young boy, shorter, thinner, and lighter than the AK-47 he carries, does not even have one day's opportunity to play or celebrate his birthday because he is too busy being a soldier. This is none other than hell. We have these kinds of hells because of causes and conditions, and therefore we can also exit these hells by using love and compassion as antidotes to anger and hatred, as Buddha prescribed. The concept of impermanence does not foretell Armageddon or the apocalypse, nor is it a punishment for our sins. It is not inherently negative or positive. It is simply part of the process of compounding of things. We usually appreciate only half of the cycle of impermanence. We can accept birth but not death, accept gain but not loss, or the end of exams but not the beginning. True liberation comes from appreciating the whole cycle and not grasping onto those things that we find agreeable. By remembering the changeability and impermanence of causes and conditions, both positive and negative, we can use them to our advantage. Wealth, health, peace, and fame are just as temporary as their opposites. And of course, Siddhartha wasn't favoring heaven and heavenly experiences. They are equally impermanent. So I think this realization of impermanence, which again is the first of the insights in the Vipassana practice in the Theravada tradition, can be very, very helpful to us. And again, we all have an intellectual understanding of impermanence, but that's not really helping us much in our life. We're still grasping onto things, trying to push things away. Because our behavior is not driven by our intellectual understanding. It's driven by our instinctive habit. So we need to change our instinctive habit to instinctively see things as impermanent, as constantly flowing and changing. So if we can internalize that impermanence and start to experience impermanence and realize impermanence in meditation and start to see the world around us is constantly changing and flowing, then of course we can work within that flow and navigate our way and use that flow to our advantage to navigate through life. Whereas if we don't do that and we see something pleasant, we're just going to try to grasp onto it and hold it and hope that it's stable and lasts. And we're struggling against this flow, and all that's going to happen is we're going to suffer as a result. So I think this realization of impermanence can be very helpful for that reason. But also a number of texts go on to say that the realization of impermanence actually is quite close to the realization of emptiness. So that if we can really internalize impermanence and really come to realize it, that's also not only going to be immediately practical benefit in daily life, but it's going to be a very good basis for our emptiness practice. But within the Vaibhashika Sattvantika school, there is a second way of grasping onto self. And we can see this in that objects of abandonment chart. In the first two schools, when we looked under that afflictive obscurations and we went coarse, we see this conception of a permanent, unitary, independent person. So that is this grasping onto this self. Again, this is quite a coarse idea, not something that we would normally instinctively have. But there's a more subtle level of grasping onto self in these two schools that I'd like to look at now. Yeah. 30, I think. Page 30 in the book, yeah. And that is, as we mentioned in the chart here, it says, conception of a self-sufficient, substantially existent person. So the self we're grasping onto is something it's this idea of a self-sufficient, substantially existent me. What that really means, and this is something that we do instinctively have. We do instinctively have this false sense of me. We instinctively grasp onto this self. And that is the sense that, you know, whenever we do anything, there seems to be a me here that is the agent. And it seems to be somehow mixed in here somewhere. And this sense of me that we have is, it seems to be very self-sufficient, meaning this me that seems to be here somewhere doesn't seem to really rely on anything else to exist. It's self-sufficient and it seems something very substantial, something very solid. And we have this a little bit in our language, this idea. You know, we say, my body, my mind. As if somehow here somewhere there's a me that has a body and has a mind. And that it's a little bit distinct from the body and the mind. That the body and the mind is something a little bit other than the me. And we also, you know, have this sense sometimes, like, for example, you know, we may look at our body and we go, oof, I don't like this body. In fact, I'd like to swap it for a younger, more beautiful, more healthy body. So sometimes we have these thoughts, you know, swap this body for a better one. And then sometimes we look at our mind and think, oh, what a mess. I'd like to swap this mind for a more intelligent, loving mind. And sometimes we may have these thoughts. But actually, where is this me here that could do this swap? Because if we take away this body and we take away the mind, is there anything left? Maybe not. But, so, logically it seems like if we take away the body and the mind, there's nothing really left. But, instinctively, we have the sense there is something more than simply the body and the mind here. There's something a little bit more than the body and the mind, this me. This me here that has this body and has this mind. We have this instinctive sense of me. That, according to Buddhism, is a false sense of me. That is grasping onto this self. And this idea of self, sometimes is called the idea of the master or the controller. That somewhere in here, there is this me that is the master or the controller of this body and the mind. And so then in the Vaibhashika Saitrantika school, the selflessness of person that we're trying to realize is to realize that there is no such self. And I think this is a little bit what people sometimes come to experience a little bit, you know, in these Goenka Vipassana retreats. Because again, this idea of this solid me is often on the basis of a solid body. And in that Goenka Vipassana retreat, if we have good mindfulness, then what we're going to notice is that what's actually here is simply a flow of physical sensations that's called the body, and we also have simply this flow of mental experience called the mind. And that, in our direct experience, there's nothing more than that here. And then that, this solid sense of me can collapse, and we can have this experience of no self or selflessness. So, according to the Vaibhashika Saitrantika school, if we can come to directly realize that there is no such self, this is the fundamental ignorance that is trapping us in samsara. And by realizing this, no such self, we can achieve the goal of nirvana. So any questions about any of those two ideas?
Yeah, when you say substantia exists, are you referring to the self doesn't substantia exist? Or the self exist?
Again, within the Vaibhashika Saitrantika school, the body does substantially exist. What is there are these tiny particles that are constantly vibrating and flowing, but they're there. So there's no problem with that. But it's the person that seems to be substantial. Anything else anyone would like to ask about these two? So when we talk about going back to the third seal, all phenomena empty selfless, then these two schools talk about the word empty meaning we're empty of this self, and the word selfless is referring to this. So this is the selflessness or no self that we need to realize in the Vaibhashika Saitrantika school to achieve liberation from samsara, to achieve nirvana. And if we can really realize there is no such self, then what you're going to find again is that that's going to be very helpful to us in daily life, that we're not going to be so much caught up in a craving, an attachment, aversion, and we're going to find that because there's no real controller, no real master separate from the body and the mind, then you'll find that there'll be a lot less frustration when you don't get things you want. You'll find there'll be less dissatisfaction when they don't live up to your expectations. You'll find there'll be a lot less fear and anxiety about the world, because we don't have this sense of being this me here that's trying to control and be the master of everything. Yeah.
Also, yeah. All
together. Yeah,
all,
yeah. So in the, as we saw in the chart here, the first two schools refute both. And that this idea of self, we don't really need to be too concerned about, because we don't instinctively have this wrong sense of me. This one we do. And so when we meditate, we can come to realize there's no such self. And according to these schools, Vaibhashika Saitrantika, we will achieve nirvana if we come to realize that.
I think the ticks and the crosses are a bit misleading. The ticks mean refuting rather than...
Well, selflessness, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. not self, but selflessness.
Yes.
So Vaibhakya is saying there is a selfness as a person, but there's not a selfness as a phenomena.
Yeah.
We need to come to realize this. Yeah, I mean, of course, if you take out that, then we have the opposite.
Yeah.
So there is no self and no mind, body, what?
Right, yeah. So again, no Buddhist school says there's no person. All Buddhist schools say there is person. The question is, how do we exist?
Yeah.
And the first two schools say we do not exist in this way.
Okay.
Yeah. And if we come to realize that we do not exist in this way, we can achieve liberation from samsara. And that the person is something labeled on the basis of the body and the mind. I mean, all the Buddhist schools say this, but what they really mean by labeled on the basis of the body and mind is a little bit different, which we're going to talk about later. But all Buddhist schools say that the person does not exist in this way. This is a false sense of me. And these two schools say that if you realize this, you can achieve nirvana.
Yeah, what you're going to get to now.
That's now it's coming later, in fact.
Okay.
Later. Okay. So, what we can understand then from these two schools is, again, the problem is how we see ourselves as a person. We overinflate the sense of me, we grasp onto there's a solid, substantial, self-sufficient me here, and that's driving, causing all of our mental afflictions, attachment, aversion, creating all of our suffering. If we realize there's no such self, we can achieve nirvana, liberation. Phenomena, of course, in these two schools, there is an independent objective world out there. There's no problem with that. Again, the problem is only how we see ourselves as a person. We overinflate the sense of me. And of course, in these two schools, there's not really any differentiation between nirvana and enlightenment. So here in this table, this objects of abandonment, when it says cognitive obscurations, it says none for these two schools. Meaning, cognitive obscurations are what is stopping us from going on to achieving enlightenment. But because enlightenment is more or less seen the same as the liberation, nirvana, then the only thing we have to get rid of in these two schools are these afflictive obscurations, this ignorance and the mental afflictions. So these are the first two schools. Now, both the Chittamatra and the Majjhimika system of schools, they both say that they're in fact, I mean, of course, these schools here would accept that there is no such self. But they would also say that there is some deeper level of ignorance that we have to address as well. And so again, just to sort of try and make it clear, because we're going to launch into these two schools after the break, the Chittamatra and the Majjhimika system, is, again, that the Vaibhashika and Sautrantika, with respect to phenomena, they say that there in fact is an independent, objective, external world there. So they accept this. Again, the problem here in these two schools is just how we see ourselves as a person. This self, grasping onto self, solid, substantial, self-sufficient, substantial, existent me. Both the Chittamatra and Majjhimika would say that even though the world appears to be like this, these appearances are deceiving us. And that this is an ignorance we need to get rid of. The ignorance grasping onto an independent external world is a deeper level of ignorance that we are suffering from. Now, how the Chittamatra and Majjhimika interpret this is different. So the Chittamatrans say there's no independent external world because that world that appears to be out there is not, there is no external world. The world is internal to the mind, even though it appears to be external. So the Chittamatrans say there's no independent external world because it's actually an independent internal world. I'm going to come to that. And so hence this idea of internal world, Chittamatra meaning mind only, meaning for them, even though things appear to be external to us, there appears to be this solid physical reality made up of material particles. That's an illusion. And they, as one of the things that to back up their theory, is that they say, well, it's like a dream. In a dream, there appears to be a dream me, and there appears to be an independent dream world out there. And often we go to the dream and we go, wow, that's really solid. And we believe in that solidness in the dream. But then, of course, if we become lucid in the dream, we realize we're dreaming, then there still will appear to be this solid world out there. But we realize that this world that seems to be there, this made of material particles, completely doesn't exist, because we'll realize that this world is a product of our mind. So they say that the waking world is like that. So that's their assertion. The Majjhimikas, they also say there's no independent external world, but they would disagree with the Chittamatrans. They would say, they would say there's a dependent external world, meaning that there appears to be an independent external world out there, but those appearances are deceiving us. And that world is external, but it's dependent. What we mean by dependent, of course, we're going to talk a lot about tomorrow. So, what I wanted to just briefly show is that both Chittamatra and Majjhimika say that the world that appears to us is deceiving us. There is no independent, objective, external world there, but they come to different conclusions. Chittamatran says that's because that world is internal to the mind. Whereas the Majjhimikas would say no, it's external, but it's dependent on the mind. So that's a little bit the difference between these two schools. What that really means in terms of internal, external, dependent, independent, we're of course going to look at. But I thought I'd just briefly mention that, because we're going to launch into these two schools in the next session. So we've still got a couple of minutes left before the break. So is there any questions about this? again, it's just a brief introduction so far.
You were talking about the Vashyaka and Sudanshika together.
Yeah.
There must be some fine distinction.
There are, and we saw one fine distinction in your Buddhist tenet systems is one accepts this, what's called self-cognition, and the other one does not. But again, in terms of nature reality, it's not relevant. Self-cognition is just how do we know that we are experiencing something? Meaning, how does memory work, really? How do we know that we experienced that at that time? And some schools say, oh, because this is self-cognition. And other schools say, no, we don't need to postulate this idea for memory to work. But anyway, it's not important here and we can leave it out. There are other differences between Vaibhashika and Sautrantika, but again, we really don't need to go into that here. If you want to study that, then that's good to do. And you can see the differences. But they're common in terms of this, and they're both common in terms of what do we mean by selflessness or grasping to self. And that's what we're focusing on here. So in that respect, they're the same, but in other related areas, there's some differences of understanding or opinion.
What you're saying about the cup kind of reminds me of a film they saw about Bruce Lee, that he had like another understanding of like the way material, that like, he could do something so small and break completely like a wood. So it's like kind of like seeing a reality like that and a way to like be able to, I don't know, like, I'm kind of trying to catch exactly what you were saying. And it keeps referring, you know, to Matrix, that I told you, like, the discussions about what's real, what's not. And I know that I'm kind of like, I'm jumping, because I'm sure that there's a process that you are on to get, but it just keep on coming back to that.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, the Matrix, of course, in fact, I know a number of Tibetan lamas who sort of like the Matrix. And different people I hear talk about Matrix sort of interpret it a little bit like this, and some interpret it a little bit like this. So, again, I mean, the thing with Matrix, of course, is, like both of these schools, the world is not as it appears. So, I mean, in that sense, you know.
Yeah, but then.
But what the, how you can interpret that, and then, of course, you can be a bit creative about that.
So we saw like what Vaibhashika and Sautrantika refutes the idea of self that we have. Are we going to see like what is their idea of self, or what is their idea of instead of what they refute?
Yeah, I mean that's going to come a little bit later, because we're going to talk about in the context of emptiness, we're going to talk about the person. But actually, very briefly, what we can do while we're here, and then we'll take the break, is if we look in that Buddhist tenet systems chart in the last column, this illustration of person. So all Buddhist schools, of course, also have to say what goes from life to life. And so this is what we mean by illustration of person. And so what we can see is in all schools, except the very last Prasangika, they all sort of pointing to something, saying that's the person. That's the thing that goes from life to life. And most of them are saying the mental consciousness.
Yeah.
As the really the person that goes from life to life. Because of course this body finishes. And so what that implies is for all of those schools, things have substantial existence.
Yeah.
And so, therefore, for all the bottom, all the lower schools, for something to exist, it must be findable. You must be able to point to something and say, that's it, there. Yeah? Whereas, if we go to the last school, the Prasangika, which we're going to be focusing on mainly, when it talks about illustration of person, what do we see? The mere eye, which is imputed, depends on the five aggregates. So there's nothing there to point to. And so that's really the difference, not only between the Vaibhashika Sautrantika, but all the lower schools and the school we're following here in the Heart Sutra, the Prasangika, is that there is some findable reality. Of course, What that findable reality looks like, of course, is a little bit different in the schools, but it's still findable. It's point to say, that's it, there it is. So that's why in all those lower schools, when we say, well, what according to Buddhism is the thing that goes from life to life? As you can see, most of them are saying the mind or the continuum of the mind. That's it. That's the person. Because that's the thing that goes on. But the Prasangikas, who we're going to look at, would say, you're still grasping. You're still grasping. And we're going to look at that, of course, that difference. I mean, we're just introducing things now. You know? But we're going to now, in the next session, look at the Chittamatra and Majjhimika. We're going to have a look at the sort of the difference between the two in the next session. So let's have a tea break and come back and try to do that.